Welcome to the Culture and Sports Podcast, where we have discussions about how leadership and organizational culture impact organizational success, team and athlete performance, and the short and long-term mental, physical, and emotional health of athletes. The Culture and Sports Podcast is brought to you by Culture and Sports. Culture and Sports helps sports organizations, teams, coaches, support and front office staff, and athletes understand the importance of leadership and organizational culture and its direct impact to success. I'm Dr. Jeremy Piasecki, and this is the Culture and Sports Podcast. Welcome to Season 3 of the Culture and Sports Podcast, where we discuss the impact of leadership and organizational culture on organizational success, team and athlete performance, and the short and long-term mental, physical, and emotional health of athletes. I would like to introduce you to a very special guest. And he's also the first guest of this season, Richard McInnes. He's the Executive General Manager of Sport and Community Capability for the Australian Sports Commission. He also has worked across the depth of the sporting landscape from community to elite, both domestically and internationally. He spent the first decade of that predominantly in coaching roles in Australia, but then transitioned into high performance management and then into executive management roles. He has a Bachelor of Applied Science in Human Movement and is currently undertaking an Executive Master's in International Sport. Richard, please tell us a little bit about your sports journey.
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy. Thanks for having me. As per your intro, it's been quite a eclectic journey. I think one of the things I'm really proud of is that I've worked and volunteered at all different levels of sport, from community grassroots to running coaching clinics for primary school kids all the way up to, the highest level, coaching teams to world championships and world cups, et cetera, and then through to, CEO roles of national sporting organisations. So a real broad mix of roles, and I think that has enabled me to have a really good understanding of the sporting landscape.
Now, I find your career, extraordinarily interesting. I mean, you went from cricket to netball to water polo. Like, what made you transition through all those sports?
Yeah, it is an interesting journey, and people are always curious about it. Once I moved away from the direct coaching role and into the high-performance management and senior management type roles, sport-specific knowledge then becomes less important, because the matters that you're dealing with and the issues that you're dealing with and the challenges are quite consistent across sports then. So as soon as you move away from the, what I like to say is, the further away from the field of play you get, the easier it is to transition across sports, because there's a lot more similarities and differences the further away from the actual game you get.
So no,
and I think there's actually been advantages for me going into sports that I haven't played, and I never played netball, I never played water polo, and so you can move into those sports without any preconceived ideas or any historical baggage, which often comes with moving through into management roles within your own sport, because everyone has a history within the sport, and perceptions, good, bad, or indifferent. And so coming into a sport without any of that sport-specific background has its advantages, it has its limitations too, and you've got to make sure you have people around you that have the sport-specific knowledge to complement your lack of, or my lack of, sport-specific knowledge.
That is very true, what you just finished with there. Would you say the organizational cultures were different in these sports, and if so, how were they different?
Subtly different, yes. Certainly going from, and I suppose the three different main sports that I've worked in, so cricket, netball, and then water polo, the main difference has been around cricket in Australia is probably Australia's number one sport. Okay, so high profile, well-resourced, well-funded. Although within that role, I worked in both the men's and the women's programs, and the men's program was extremely well-resourced and well-funded. The women's program wasn't at the time, probably is now. Netball was in between. They were on the cusp of really being and in moving into being a professional sport. And then water polo, being an Olympic sport, is a elite amateur sport, if you like. The athletes aren't paid. There's minimal resources, minimal finances in the game. So some stark differences in the operational delivery in those sports, but from a culture point of view, a lot of similarities. You know, when you're working in sport, you're dealing with people that are really passionate about it. They have an emotional contract with the sport that you don't get in if you're working for a listed company and everyone's an employee. It's very different to working in sports where you have a lot of people that are volunteering their time, they're emotionally connected to the sport. And so that brings with it its own type of culture, and all of those sports had that.
Oh, okay. That's great to hear. So, talking about the different organizational cultures, how did your leadership style like work with each of the different organizational cultures? Because you're talking about there's a lot of similarities, but I'm sure there was different stakeholders in each of the organizations. There's a lot of like the old guard that was there when you were coming in, and they wanted to tell you how things worked in that organization. Like, where did your leadership style come in, and how did you make it work with each different organization and its culture?
Look, it's a really good question because I think my leadership style through those three roles has evolved significantly. When I was in leadership roles in the cricket community, I was a very different leader to what I am now. I was relatively young in those roles. I was a national coach in my early 30s, which is quite young. And I probably felt at the time that I always had to prove myself because I was much younger than everyone else that was in those sort of roles. And I was always trying to race ahead and do things better and faster than everyone else. And you talk about the people that are the traditional, custodians and owners of the sport, the people that have been around it a long time. When I was in cricket, I probably got frustrated with those people because they weren't ready to move as fast as I wanted to move. And we still had success, but I look back now and think, geez, I wish I was in those roles now, 10 years later or 15 years later, because I would have done it differently and probably done it better than what I did now. So certainly that leadership style has evolved as I've learned lessons about and learned about myself over time to, probably in the water polo role that I've literally finished up yesterday as I move into this new role with the Sports Commission. I was really focused on embracing the people, the custodians of the sport and the people that have been around it a long time, and my leadership style has really evolved into much more of a servant leadership style. How do we engage people and build relationships and get it? You're never going to get everybody on the journey or on the bus, but you need to get most of them on the journey, or you won't go anywhere. And I think that's been a really valuable lesson over, 15 years or more, probably now. Of an evolving leadership style. But I think that's critical. You can have the best ideas on the planet, write the best plans. If you don't have people on board, it doesn't matter how good your plans are because they won't work.
No, that's definitely true. So, I've coached in a lot of different areas in the world in my time as well. But you've also coached and led in different countries, both in Australia and in Bangladesh. What were the differences, not only in your own leadership, but in leadership in both countries and the organizational cultures and the national governing bodies and teams that you worked with?
Quite stark differences between Australia and Bangladesh. Australia is a very flat structure. We don't have hierarchies. It's a very egalitarian society. Nobody likes being told what to do in Australia. We're fiercely independent across the board, and whereas in Bangladesh, a traditional hierarchical culture and people knew their sort of place in society, whether that's right or wrong, that's how it functions, and I learned a lot about operating in that model, which was quite challenging for me because I was very egalitarian. I didn't believe in class levels, and I would, some great examples of it was that I would always carry my own bags, and if we were the training sessions and kit bags, and I would always carry my own bags. I would be horrified to ask someone else to carry my bag, and that some of the younger people and the you know, we would have you know, I still have a lot of good friends in Bangladesh, and there was young boys there that were basically homeless, but we would engage them to help out around, and we'd give them that was food and lodgings, and that got them off the street and that sort of stuff. And they would want to carry bags, and I would say, no, it's all right, I can carry my own bags. And but I was taking a job off them, and so I was taking
Right.
their sense of value was associated with being able to do that for me, and I wasn't letting them do it. And so I learned that quickly, and got advised by, you know, local people there to say, no, that's what they do, and that's what they want to do. So you need to let them do that. And that was, and that flowed all the way through the system over there. And so you had to understand that, and so I had to evolve and change how I operated to suit that. And you know, neither's yeah. You know, the thing I did learn is that it works. Yeah, it works. It works in Bangladeshi society. That's how it works, and everybody understands that, and it works well. And if you try and come in and impose an Australian culture into a different culture, or vice versa, it doesn't fit. And I've seen that in water polo as well. We have a lot of European coaches come to Australia and try and impose the European style of coaching onto Australian people, and it's just a mismatch of culture. And there's parts of it you can adopt, but there's parts of it that
Right.
just won't work, and vice versa. If we were to go and coach in Australian water polo coach was to go and coach in Europe, they would have challenges going back the other way.
I mean, that's definitely true. I mean, I myself like coached water polo in Europe.
Okay.
I also played for a time, and you know, the organizations that I worked with were very welcoming, and they actually wanted to learn you know, the way that we coached in the U.S. And I actually tried to explain to them I'm also different from coaches in the U.S. And so I'm not the right authority to talk to about that because when I was coaching there, I was putting a lot of focus and responsibility onto the athletes because it was their team. It wasn't my team as a coach. And that was a struggle for a lot of the athletes. And same thing when I was coaching in Afghanistan. You know, those athletes were like, well, I don't have a say in what we're doing here. And I said, no, you have the say of what's happening here. Like, this is your team. You know, I'm just here to help you be successful and to find the great things that you have hidden inside of you that you don't even know. And whether it was an athlete, a coach, or even like, the Secretary General, you know, I was always telling them, this is your program. I'm just here to help you as much as I can. So, but I definitely understand what you're saying because, like when I was in Afghanistan, for example, you know, I struggled a little bit because I was a very young coach. I was a very young person in general when I was coaching there, and you know, and I struggled because I wasn't always opening my eyes and putting my foot in their shoes to be like, how do we make this the most successful? And the moment that I stopped trying to do anything that I thought was best, and I was doing everything solely for what was best for the athletes and what was best for their culture and the, you know, so many different languages and ethnic groups, you know, within Afghanistan. Once I let them take in a run with it, I mean, you know, the sport just exploded, you know, both swimming and water polo and even open water swimming just exploded in Afghanistan. So that was very exciting. When you were in Bangladesh, did you find some similarities with that?
Yeah, 100%. You know, your story there about trying to give them ownership of, you know, game plans or their own destiny in terms of where they're going as an athlete, that was just a foreign concept. They were just, you know, the Bangladesh players were just used to being told what to do. They weren't really allowed or encouraged to think for themselves.
Right.
They were told what to do. But if you're going to be a good athlete in a game, particularly in a game like cricket, for example, and most sports are the same, where you have to make decisions on the fly. You need to be reading what's going on in the game and adapting as you go. And if you don't have that ability and aren't confident to do that, well, you're going to get found out in the game and not succeed. So it was fundamental to not disrespect their culture and their traditions But to say, hang on, well, if you actually want to be really successful here as a player, you need to be able to think for yourself and make decisions. And that's okay. And to really understand that you are going to get some of those decisions wrong, maybe more than you get right, but that's okay. But you have to make a decision. Not making a decision was worse. So you have to make decisions, and you learn from each one of those that you make. So, yeah, but it was a great experience. You know, a great learning experience for me. And no doubt your journey was as well through Afghanistan.
Exactly. So I have to ask you a question. Right now you're transitioning from being the CEO of Water Polo Australia, which for those of you who don't follow water polo, they are one of the top aquatics federations in the world. Like, you know, consistently both the women's programs and the men's programs, top 10 in the world at any given time. Yeah. Like a lot of times they're the top 5 of the world. Why are you transitioning from being the CEO of Water Polo Australia to now being the Executive General Manager of Sport and Community Capability at the Australian Sports Commission?
Yeah. Now, good question. I've done nearly 4 years in the CEO role with Water Polo, and really proud of what we've done there. And I think we've made some really good progress, and the sport's in a good position. Our women's team just came fourth in World Champs in Fukuoka. Mm-hmm. The men finished 10th this time. As you said, you know, we're sort of in the top 10. I think, you know, outside of the US, we're the only country in the top 10 that doesn't have a professional domestic league, although the US has obviously got the college system, which is probably better than most professional leagues around the world. So we certainly punch above our weight there. Our swimmers certainly dominate the world, and they are again in the world champs at the moment. So why the transition? Look, the role I'm going into will basically allow me to do what I've done in water polo, but across all sport in Australia. And it's about building capability and capacity within the sporting organisations across the country, and helping them, not doing their job for them, but helping them to build capability and capacity so they can deliver a better sporting experience for the people within their respective sports. So it's certainly a step up the role, even though I'm reporting to a CEO now. It's certainly a step up, and the breadth of the role is really exciting. And I've always been someone that's always had a really system-wide approach to whatever mm-hmm. I was doing. So even when I was coaching, I was always thinking about the broader system. I was never just focused on the players under my control or influence. It was more about how do we influence the system that's producing these players so that as players come into that team, they're better prepared? How do we influence the coaching that's, you know, producing all the players that feed into the national team? So I've always had that view of the world, regardless of the role that I've been in, and this role allows me to do that absolutely, because that's what the role is. It's a real system approach.
Now, during your tenure as the CEO of Water Polo Australia, you had like very good growth for a national governing body. Was your focus on grassroots programs? Like, how were you continuing to get that growth, like even through COVID? And I know that COVID was a tough time for everyone in sports, and even afterwards, like the next few years, because so many youth didn't really participate in sports or left sports for a few years. How did you still account for the growth in your sport, like especially at the grassroots level?
And it's something we're really, really proud of, because in Australia, and probably like most countries around the world, participation rates, particularly in team sports, has declined over the last decade, over the last 20 years. So we've had year-on-year growth over the last 3 or 4 years, which has been really exciting. How we went about that, there's a range of things. It's not just one. We didn't just focus on participation. You know, I think everything's connected. Nothing in sport occurs in isolation. So we had to make sure that our national teams were, you know, performing as well as we could with the resources and the access that we had. They assist to inspire our future players that are in our system. And then we did some really interesting stuff with trying to engage new people in the sport. So you'll probably appreciate, but the water polo is what's called an invasion sport. right? So, and you know, that two teams attack and defend territory, score goals or points. That's an invasion sport. And within Australia, water polo is the only invasion sport played in summer. But in winter, we have a whole lot of invasion sports. All of our football codes, you know, basketball, netball, hockey, soccer. There's a lot of invasion sports played in winter in Australia, and those games fundamentally are the same structure as water polo. They're just on land, but they're team
right.
sports. They involve a ball. They involve scoring goals. They involve attacking and defending territory. So we did a big push on trying to engage a lot of those winter invasion sport athletes to come and try water polo. Come and do something in your off season to help stay fit, really low injury risk. You're in the water in Australia in summer with your mates, with your friends. You know, what is there not to like about it? So
exactly.
We saw some really good growth there, in the thousands of people that came and tried that through the last couple of summers. And then the other piece we did was in Australia, and I'm sure in the US it's similar, the Learn to Swim programs. You know, there are, you know, in obviously a much smaller population, but there are about 1.4 million children doing Learn to Swim programs in Australia every year. You know, we're surrounded by water, it's a swimming country, but not everyone wants to follow the black line up and down.
Right.
You know, and swim. But we love the water as a nation. We love the water, and parents want their kids to be safe in the water. So what we tried to do was embed some awareness of water polo into Learn to Swim programs. We weren't teaching them how to play the game, but we're introducing a ball. So I had a vision that, you know, every kid that's doing Learn to Swim in Australia knows what water polo is. They've seen a ball. They know it's a game. So when they progress through their Learn to Swim program or they finish it, and they want to stay involved in a water activity, water polo is an option. And if we can pick up, you know, even a small percentage of that 1.4 million that then become water polo players, that will over time help us really grow our participation base. So that yielded some pretty good results too, and that'll continue to grow over time. So I think that's basically how we did it. The other piece was around creating, and you know, topical for this podcast, but creating a culture we're proud of, and creating a culture that people want to be part of, and that people encourage their friends to come and be part of. And that's a work in progress. You know, we that involves a lot of work with our coaches and our administrators and our volunteers, and player behavior and coach behavior, and making sure that if someone rocks up to a game of water polo, they look at it and go, wow, that looks like something I really want to be part of. And that's a, you know, that visual is, or that experience is all encompassing. It's how people talk to each other. It's the, you know, the general vibe around the pool. Are people smiling? Are they happy? Do they look like they're enjoying themselves? And so we've worked pretty hard to try and influence that. That's not something you can just flick a switch and change overnight. But how do we innovate and improve that culture so that it is something that we can be really proud of?
So I heard that under your leadership from a parent, actually, in Australia, that the programs in Australia have been way more inclusive the past few years than they were at any time that they're knowledgeable of. Like, what did you do to make the sport more inclusive? Like, I know you're making connection with the sport with Learn to Swim programs and you know, getting, you know, players – you know, to bring, you know, potential new players, you know, because a lot of youth sports, it's a lot of social, you know, based where, you know, people want to be with their friends, or they want to bring their friends to where they are in sports. But how did you make it more inclusive than it was before?
Yeah, so it's probably, I'm not sure which parent or who you're talking to, but there's probably two elements to that. One is about making the entire sport more inclusive. So we've really worked hard to be more inclusive of all the different minority groups in the country. So whether that's the LGBTQ plus community, whether it's the multicultural community, whether it's different age demographics, certainly both genders. We're a fairly gender neutral sport, but we've done a lot of work in bringing more female coaches into the sport, because even though our participation base was fairly even, our coaching ranks were heavily skewed towards males. So we've done a lot of work in balancing that out and making sure that our female coaches are provided with opportunities. In terms of What's really interesting in Australia is more than half of our population are born overseas. So we need to make sure that we're, and we've got a really big South Asian population. So India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka is a big portion of the Australian population. So how do we make the game appealing to them? So we've had to work really hard on that, and we've been really public with that. The other thing we've done from an inclusion point of view is through our athlete pathways programs, where we're, identifying talent and trying to bring talent through to eventually produce Olympians. There was a system in place prior to my time where, young athletes would be selected at 15, 14, 15. They'd be put into a squad of about 20. A coach would be given that group, and that coach would have that group of athletes for the next 5, 6 years, getting them ready for the age group world championships. Now, the issue there is that if you are every time you make a selection, you make a deselection, because you're picking one kid and you're not picking another kid or multiple other kids. Now, if I'm the coach of that team and I pick my kids at 15, 16, every kid that doesn't get picked there at that point in time, whether consciously or subconsciously, goes, you know what? This coach is in charge for the next 6 years of my age group. He didn't pick me now. He's not going to pick me. And so that kid either quits the sport, goes, I'll go and play another sport, because in Australia there's heaps of choices for sport. Or they keep playing, but you know what? They've lost that drive because they just don't think they're going to get another opportunity. And so we did a couple of things there. One, we have under 16, under 18, and under 20 national programs. The coaches now look after the kids or the selected kids for a 2-year program. And their job is to prepare them for the next age group. They don't take them all the way through. So and the squads are reselected every year. At our national championships, like your Junior Olympics, we will pick a new squad every year. Now, look, 80% of the kids will get reselected if they've continued to progress and they're working really hard, great. But the door's always open for kids that have developed. They might have grown 6 inches in the last 12 months, or they've suddenly the game's clicked and they've worked out something that they couldn't do. And so the door's always open. Every 12 months, the door's open to come in. And that way, we've got more chance of actually finding the kids who are going to be the best ones at 26, not the ones that are best at 16. And,
Exactly.
with most team sports, they don't peak until they're 26 to 36. And so what you also find is the later people have their growth spurt, the bigger they'll be. So if they grow early, if they're fully mature at 14 or 15 at, 5 foot 10, they'll be 5 foot 10 when they're 26. Whereas a kid that's, 5 foot 6 at 13 and doesn't grow till they're 18, they could finish up being 6 foot 6, So that's, we needed to, we needed, we were shooting ourselves in the foot. And Australia's got a really small population base compared to the US. We need to maximize our numbers as well as we can. So we can't afford to be, deselecting kids too early. And we made our squads bigger. So we tried to, the philosophy was keep as many kids in the pathway for as long as we practically can, without really diluting the quality of the work we could do. But because there's that balancing act, you can't have a national squad of 100 because you can't do anything. You can't, it's too big. But we went from 20 to maybe having 50 that are on the radar. And how do we, progressively make that smaller over time, not cut it off at 15 or 16?
Exactly,
So I think
exactly.
that's, I think that's certainly helped. But it's a slow burn. We won't see the results of that for 5 to 10 years. I don't expect
Exactly.
it's not going to get
Yeah,
instant
no,
results.
that's a long-term plan that you have to wait to see how it happens. But yeah, you made some great points about deselecting athletes, especially because, at 14, 15, I mean, that's so young. How are you supposed to determine someone in a team sport, so early on? That's something I think that coaches and national governing bodies in all countries really need to think about. So I want to go
100%.
back to something you said earlier. You were saying about something about nothing occurs in isolation. Can you expand on that a little bit more?
Well, I mean, we live and operate in a system, and it's all connected. So, without getting, you know, too philosophical, but everything we do impacts on something else, and everything that, not everything, but lots of things, we impact on lots of things, and we're impacted by lots of things. So I think what I really, as a leader, what I try and do, and what I really encourage staff and anyone I'm working with to do, is think about, okay, whatever the project is I'm working on, who else can that help, or who else can that influence? And I need to make sure I'm talking to that person, or I'm considering what they're trying to do, because I can actually either amplify or I can harm what they're trying to do, depending on what I do. And on the other side of that coin is, who's doing work that actually is going to feed into or influence what I'm trying to do? And how do I build a relationship with that person or that group or that organization so that we can maximize the change? So, you know, if we, as an example, you know, a sport example, what we just talked about with that, the shift in selection and identification of young talent. Now, we worked out that, when we pick our national squads, that squad will only spend about 20, 25 days a year together, right? Now, if I'm the coach of that national team, I get those athletes for 20 or 25 days a year. Now, you've coached, you'll understand that if you see kids for 20 or 25 days a year, there's not much influence you're having directly, because it's not enough time. They're spending 340 days a year back with their club coach. So what's happening in their club environment is going to have more impact on the performance of the national team than what you do when you have them in camp for 20 or 25 days. So how do we influence and look at what's happening in the club environment on the every week, every other day when they're training there? Because if we can support and enhance that, that will help. When those kids come into a national camp, we have some understanding of where they're going to be at and what we can do in the national camp to add value. So when we appointed our national age group coaches, we didn't necessarily need the best technical water polo coach, because they would have minimal time with the athletes. What we needed was a national coach who could build really good relationships with club coaches and provide clarity and direction of what the athletes were going to need to make the Australian side. It's a very different approach. And we certainly got some criticism, because people went, hang on, why are you... People didn't think about it. So if you're just thinking in isolation, and I think that's one of the challenges we've had sometimes with our European coaches coming out, and they're used to being a club coach where they've got one job. They've got to coach 13 players for the club. And then you come into a state or a national system here, and your responsibility is far broader.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, and it's not just 13 athletes, it's hundreds or thousands of coaches and thousands or tens of thousands of athletes. I mean that's just, you know, to put it simply.
So that's just trying to put that in a sporting lens, but it's just an approach that I take, is that, you know, the only way that those things work is if those relationships exist, about thinking about how am I connecting to the other one, because I can do a great job by myself, but that's going to have minimal impact really in a broader system. I need to be influencing more broadly.
Now, speaking of influence, like in your entire career, you know, at any organization you've been at, where do you believe you've made the most impact or influenced like the most positive change?
Good question. You probably have to ask the organisations I've worked in. Look, I'd like to think that I've made an influence wherever I've been. Now, and hopefully most of that is positive. I'm sure there will be some people that will say, no, I haven't, and that's okay. My time in Bangladesh, I think, was really valuable, and I think I made a pretty significant influence there on groups, you know, a large group of players who went on to become that country's most successful athletes, and changed the landscape for that nation as a cricket nation. Now, I certainly don't for a second take all the credit for that, but I had an influence along with some, you know, plenty of other people. But we worked really hard to teach those young men who were at the age of sort of 16, 17, 18, 19, 20 and early 20s, teach them how to train so they could compete at the international level, because they didn't know that. They didn't have that. They'd never seen it. They had skills, but they didn't know how to train. They didn't know how to prepare. So I think that was a pretty significant influence on that country. I think if I look at my time in women's cricket, we made some fundamental shifts there in the game, in terms of how we played the game and the format. So I'm not sure how familiar you are with cricket, but there's three different formats. There's test cricket, which goes for 5 days. There's one day cricket, which goes for a full day. And then there's T20 cricket, which is more like baseball. You know, it's about 3 hours in length. And in Australian cricket, in women's cricket at the time, this was the late 2000s, we made a strategic decision that if the women's game was going to grow and get great publicity, it was going to be via the shortest format, not the longest mm-hmm. format. And so that we made some strategic decisions then about all of our competition structures of from under 13s, 15s, 17s coming up. We made the strategic decisions about the types of athletes we needed to select and the way we wanted to play so that we would be best suited to T20 cricket, so the shortest format, and the skill set required and the athleticism required. And so that was probably 2009, 10 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And that team and that the group of athletes who were at the time 15, 16 to 20 years old have dominated global cricket for the last decade and continue to do so. You know, they've won 3, 4, 5 world titles in that time in two different formats. But yeah, so there's an influence there. And again, can't take all the credit for it, but I was national coach at the time, so I had an influence on that, and we made some decisions there. And then, you know, in the water polo space, I think, you know, we've touched on a bit of it about how we're trying to grow the game, how we're trying to be more inclusive, you know, commercially, how we're thinking about what we can offer as a sport. You know, we've done a lot of work on our social impact, so talking about climate sustainability, reconciliation with our Indigenous community, inclusion, diversity and equity, and then culture. So some projects there to try and position the sport and create a culture that we're really proud of, and a culture that enables us to generate and find commercial partners and philanthropic partners that are supportive of what we're trying to achieve beyond the pool, that we're trying to have a really positive impact on society.
So, as a leader, was being your authentic self through all these organizations, was that like important to you?
Yeah.
And working with, you know, whether you're the CEO or an assistant coach somewhere, why was that important? And did it help others, whether it's athletes or coaches or you know, front office or support staff? Like, did it help them also become their authentic selves when they were there at work with you?
Yeah. I think that journey for me about being your authentic self would go hand in hand with my evolution in my style, the evolution of my style of leadership. As I said at the start, when I first sort of moved into leadership roles, I was quite young and I was trying to prove myself to people, and I was probably trying to be something I wasn't because I thought that's what I should be. Pardon me. And then over time, you know, and through some tough times as well where things didn't go to plan and, you know, got some pretty brutal feedback, you realize, hang on, well, I'm trying to be something I'm not, and that's mm-hmm. some of that's working, but some of it's not. So it's much easier just to be yourself, and when I say that is, and be aware of yourself, be aware of the things that you do well and be aware of the things that you don't do so well, and make sure you're aware of it and you can catch yourself and manage those situations. So I think that has evolved over time, and I'm very genuine with people. I'm very honest with people, probably to a fault sometimes. I share sometimes too much information and I'm too trusting, but that's me. So I'm genuine to that, and if you're trying to be something you're not, then it can be very tiring too, because it's always a show, it's always an act or a show. So I've just been myself. My values are pretty consistent, and I just live to those. And don't try and change too much, and just do the right thing by people. And if you do that, I don't think you're going to go too far wrong. But I think it is really important. And I think you need, if you want your staff and your teams to do well, and you need them to be themselves. Mm-hmm. And the best way to do that is to lead by that example. Hopefully that answers that.
So back when you were coaching, did you take into account your perceptions and biases with your interactions with like athletes, coaches, and staff?
Yeah. I got better at that, and I think I've improved at that over time. But I certainly know, like as an athlete, I was an average. I was okay, right? So I always had an affinity for athletes who were just on the cusp, and I know I had a bias for that. So I always had a really good work ethic and still do, but as an athlete, I trained hard. I always tried to be the fittest, and, you know, I didn't have the skills of some of the others, but I always trained really well. And so I had a bias, an unconscious bias probably early, but then a conscious bias of I related to athletes who were similar to that. But I became aware of that pretty quickly. And I think you have to, We all have biases, but we're, because of our own experiences, it's just making sure you're aware of that and being able to call that out on yourself. So when you're in, you know, selection meetings, in a selection panel, you just need to be, it's almost like a conflict of interest. You just need to say, look, I really like this player, but I always like that type of player. Now, that may not be what we need in this team right now, but so just putting that on the table, what do we need? And if this player is the right fit, then great.
Oh, that's awesome. Hmm. So a couple minutes ago, you were talking about values. Let's talk about your values and beliefs. Like, how did they influence your coaching?
Yeah, and they've probably evolved over time, but I think I've sort of settled over the last decade on, you know, around trust, integrity, teamwork and innovation, or team and innovation. So as I said before, I'm a very trusting person. I don't think you can build relationships without trust, and I tend to try and pay that forward. I'll trust people until I can't, and I'll trust them first, and try and build those relationships. Integrity for me is important in that you've got to do what you say you're going to do, you know. And I know we all get busy, and there's an allowance there that you're not always going to get everything done, but the effort's got to be there that if I say I'm going to do something, I'm going to do that. From a team, you know, being one of those values is around, it's not about me and my success or my, you know, rewards. It's about what, depending on what the role is, what's the best thing for the team, for the organization, for my staff. I'm always going to put that first in whatever I do. It's not about personal rewards for me. Okay. And then innovation. And for me, innovation is purely about how do we make something better. It's not necessarily technology or, you know, gadgets. It's about how do we innovate? How do we get better? And it might be stopping doing something or doing something differently. I've always keen to explore how we can do things differently. So I've tried to apply that in every role I've been in, those values from coaching to management to where I am now.
So you said just a minute ago, when you say you're going to do something, you need to do it. Are you talking about self-accountability, or are you talking about holding everyone else accountable?
Both. I think, you know, if we commit to doing something as, or if I commit to doing something, I need to do that, or I need to make sure that that happens. And equally, if we commit to doing something as an organization, so we write our strategy documents, and we write our operational plans, and if we say we're going to do something, well, that's the plan we're going down. Now, that doesn't mean you don't adjust and review and refine as you go, but then you call that out, and you communicate that, because, you know, if you write a plan where you can complete everything, then your plan was not ambitious enough. Yeah, you're not aiming high enough. So, but you just need to call out at some point and go, okay, look, we set ourselves to do that. We're just not going to get there this year or in this cycle because of XYZ. So let's park that one, and we'll come back to that in the next cycle, or we'll do something different. But don't just pretend it's not there and not do anything or not say anything. So yeah, I think it's important.
So as the CEO, or now former CEO of Water Polo Australia, what did success look like when you first entered the role, and now that you completed your time there? So
Yeah.
again, like what was success back then when you first stepped in? Oh, we're gonna win a world championship. And then what is that success now? What does that look like?
Yeah. Look, when I came into the role, the sport was widely described as being a bit of a basket case. There was a lot of dysfunction within the member organisations. So within Australian sport, it's a federated model. So you've got a national body, probably similar to the states, and then you've got state members, state bodies underneath that. There was a lot of turmoil between the states were the voting members. And so my first target for success was to try and just unite the sport and to try and build relationships and get the sport back together with all these people that were really passionate about the sport. They all loved water polo, but they were arguing amongst themselves, and the sport was going nowhere. It was actually going backwards because the funding agencies were quite frustrated with the sport because of the poor governance and the internal issues, and we were actually going to lose funding, and we were losing funding from the national bodies, so, or from the peak bodies. So that was the first thing, was just to stabilize and then unite and build those relationships so that once we did want to try and take the sport forward, we actually had people on the bus to take it forward. And you know, we did a lot of that work. We had COVID in the middle of that for, you know, 18 months, 2 years, which probably slowed things down a little bit, but it did allow us to still build those relationships. And it was actually a really, interestingly enough, something like that that everyone was exposed to, in some ways, may have helped us unite the sport, because it was a common enemy, if that makes sense, right? Whereas
Right. Everyone wasn't positioning for themselves or their organizations, that they were all trying to find ways to succeed through COVID.
correct. And so that became a common enemy, and it instead of Water Polo Australia being the common enemy of all the states, COVID became the common enemy, and that allowed us to galvanize around a particular challenge. And so in some really weird ways, that might have actually been a good thing for us. Moving forward, though, you know, we've the next challenge for us now, and I think you talk about success being around, you know, winning world championships. One of the really critical things for us as a sport here is we lost 2 years of playing time, and most of Europe kept playing,
Oh,
and
yes.
you know, and so and you've seen that, and I think the US are probably feeling that a little bit at the moment as well, is we didn't play games for 2 years, and so the rest of the world that we compete against kept moving forward. And we actually went backwards because we weren't playing much at all. We certainly weren't playing international games. And we're trying to catch that up. And, you know, these world champs now in Fukuoka are probably the first sign that we're starting to make some ground back. And hopefully we can keep making that ground before Paris Olympics next year. So, yeah, we certainly want to have success in the pool. And that is one part of our mission. sustainability is a key one, and I say sustainability now across multiple lenses. So there's financial sustainability, so making sure we've got revenue streams coming in that we can enable us to do what we need to do across the sport. People sustainability, how do we make sure we can attract and maintain and retain really good staff and really good coaches and good athletes? So what are the things we need to do around that? Obviously, climate sustainability is an important one. Now, we don't have a massive carbon footprint, but we need to make sure that we're doing the right things in those spaces as well. And then sustainability of our overall of our ecosystem with our clubs and our states, mm-hmm. and making sure they're in a good position to still deliver water polo locally at community level is fundamental to our focus probably now and you know, moving forward over the next couple of years.
Now, at Water Polo Australia, what did you do to help prioritize the self-care and wellness for not only the athletes but the coaches as well? And I'm sure you did a lot of that work during the pandemic or the crucial times of the pandemic. You were probably turning to that. What do you have to say about self-care and wellness?
Yeah, look, it's a massive topic, and having been a coach for a long time, the coach is usually the last person that gets looked after. You spend all your time looking after the athletes and looking after your staff, and you know, I liken it very. Coaching role is very much like a CEO role. It can be a very lonely place and very isolating because you tend to be responsible for everyone else. What we tried to do during COVID and we still do it now is just really staying connected to people and, you know, reaching out like everyone did through COVID. We did lots of online meetings and, you know, probably to death we did too much of it. Everyone became fatigued by Zoom and Teams and everything else. But we had to try and stay connected. What I do try and do here is really create flexibility for people and allow them to prioritize the things they need to do to look after themselves. Now, that'll be different for every staff member, but we're really proud of having a flexible workplace. You know, we don't count hours, we count output. As long as you can get your job done, you do your job when you need to. We have staff now based in different locations around the country as opposed to all being based in Sydney, where when I started the entire staff was in Sydney. So now we've got people spread out, which has its own challenges, but it also has its advantages. So I think, yeah, just and if you go back to what we talked about before about being your genuine self, allowing and encouraging people to do that is a big part of well-being and people being able to look after themselves.
Now, Richard, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to meet with us today. But before we go, do you have a final statement that you'd like to make to any athlete, coach, supporting staff, high performance directors, or at like that, even the athlete support structure, like parents, whether it's in Australia or around the world?
I think a key probably summary for me, whether you're coaching teams or managing staff, is look after the person first. You know, make sure they're in a good headspace. Make sure they're able to, their lives are going okay. And if that's the case, you'll then get good output and good performances from them. And if all the individuals in your team are in a pretty good space and they're performing quite well, well, your organization or your team will then have success. But if you don't, if the person isn't functioning well as an individual in their, just in their life, it's going to be really hard to get the next two. Some people can do it, but it's very rare that they can compartmentalize their life falling apart off the field and still perform on the field. There's very few people can do that well. So I think that's really important piece of advice. We do all get caught up at times in performances and winning, and you know, that it's the be all and end all. And for me, winning is an outcome. If we've got to get the process right about looking after the people, And if you do that, you increase your chances of success. And then also, finally, just making sure that you're thinking about it from the system point of view and understanding that what you do and how it influences the people around you. And if you can influence positively, you can make great things happen.
And that's a wrap for this week's episode of the Culture and Sports Podcast. We hope that this episode has started an internal dialogue, or even one with your team, about the importance of leadership and organizational culture. If you'd like to learn more about Culture and Sports, the Culture and Sports Podcast, or other programs, go to cultureandsports.com, where there is a wealth of resources, articles, research, podcasts, video shows, webinars, and courses. And don't forget to connect with us on social media, on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube, and LinkedIn at Culture and Sports, and on Twitter at Culture in Sport. Thank you for tuning in to the Culture and Sports Podcast.